So, last day, we talked about the notion of locality and realism, right? And we discussed that experiments, the principle of locality, in a way, is very simple to understand, is that the outcome of an experiment in my lab cannot depend on the settings that I choose for the lab somewhere, a lab somewhere else, very far away. Or even if you want space like separated even. Although again, this is agnostic about what is the imposition of locality. Locality is not a relativistic thing, exists outside of that. Relativity only imposes a particular kind of locality if you want. But the idea is that then moving my knobs here would not affect a lab in Alpha Centauri. Okay, that's the idea. Remember that small a and small b represent the settings, the choice of settings that are controllable, everything that I can control in my lab. Okay, the idea is that my settings are local, so I don't allow the outcome of my experiment to depend on the settings of the knobs in Bob's lab, okay? And the same for Bob, that's the notion of locality. And then also the notion of realism is the idea that, well, the values of the result of the experiment are gonna be determined, but they have a real value and they're determined by your settings, but also a set of variables that in principle you can control. Let's call it hidden variables. You can't see it and control them, but they can be random. They don't need to be a set number of variables. They can be a random distribution if you want. In fact, I'm going to tolerate that in general, they're a random distribution, which generalizes the case where they have a value, right? If you pick a delta for them, they do have a value, right? So in general, the idea is that the values of the experiment are predetermined by a set of variables, right? And maybe I don't know them, and I implement that by including B and A to depend on a set of hidden variables, some of them in common. In general. Make sense? Yep.
I think I missed it. Can you kind of explain again why that condition, why we call it realism?
Realism is that it has a definite value, right? Like the values exist. It's not the outcome of an experiment. Is remember the black and the white ball, right? If you get one and I get the other, the state of my ball is 50-50% each, right? It's a probability distribution. But that's my ignorance only. The value the ball has a color, and it doesn't acquire a particular color when I measure it. Magically, it has a color, right? So in particular, the hidden variable there would be the color of my ball.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that every time that you say that your outcomes are determined, right? It's either your theory is fully deterministic in all the outcomes, or well, your theory is ignorant about some of them, and you need to consider them in order to explain the value that it already has. That's the lambdas. The lambdas is, well, in mind that only with the settings of A and B labs is not enough to predict the experiment always. There's going to be some noise, some probability. But if I were to know everything else in the universe, then there's no uncertainty. It has a value that is determined. Make sense?
Yeah.
So that lambda is everything else in the universe.
Yeah. I guess my confusion is why that's called realism. It doesn't seem intuitive to me why we call that stipulation realism.
So the definition of realism,
yeah,
is related to having a value. Okay. This is an implementation of it.
Okay.
The implementation is that, well, I can, so it doesn't just depend on my controllable quantities, it can depend on anything else, and that's why it can have a value that is established. If I know these two things, I would know the value. That's the idea. Make sense? All right. Good. So. Again, this is an implementation of realism. The definition of realism is conceptual, if you want, but this is an implementation of it. Okay? It has a value, and the value depends on your settings. Maybe if you know your settings is not enough to fully determine it, but there are other values, other variables that will fully determine it. That's the idea. Make sense? If it were a classical, let me put it a different way. If it were a noiseless classical experiment in a closed environment, I wouldn't have a dependence on that, if I control the parameters, you know? I would be able to determine the value only with A. But in this case, right, in general, just knowing A will not determine the full value. Knowing A will give you a probability distribution instead. So let's add everything that I'm ignorant about. That's the idea, because it has a value. That's why it's implemented realism. It has a value. If it doesn't, in my description of it, it's because I'm missing variables. Let's add them. That's the idea. Make sense? Gauss lambda has the information that you're missing about what determines the outcome of your mess. Make sense? Everybody? All right. Now we're going to look in particular at the correlators between the two measurements. Let's take a very simple case. The simple case that we're going to take is that we have a two-level system. So A and B, the experiments, are a two-level thing. The outcomes are two. That's all. Like your experiment, you're measuring something, and the outcomes are only two. All right? Say, for example, I don't know, you're measuring the direction of a spin or something like that. You have a Stern-Gerlach. You have two possible outcomes, something like that. Makes sense? Or any other experiment that is a one or a zero, the answer. Or in my case, it's going to be plus or minus one. Make sense? Everybody? Okay. Now, I'm going to compute the correlation function between the two measurements. The two-point correlator, of course, is the product of the two outcomes, if you want, but integrated over all the variables that I don't have control over. Of course, the variables are in general random. So I have a capital lambda probability distribution for the values of lambda, right? So I need to integrate over all possible values of lambda. Again, remember, if lambda is deterministic instead of probabilistic, right? If it's not randomly generated with some probability distribution, that's a particular case of that, where lambda is a delta. Make sense? All right, good. So I'm going to look at differences between two different correlators. Let's say that I take two possible lab settings for Alice and Bob. So I'm gonna take settings A and A prime for Alice's lab, and settings B and B prime for Bob's lab. Or you can think of it, if it's a Stern-Gerlach, first I have the Stern-Gerlach like that and like that, right? So A prime, and for Bob could be maybe A prime, B, B prime. It sends two different settings, two different sets of the knobs, values of the knobs for each of them. Make sense? Okay. So I'm gonna consider the difference between these two correlators. That is lambda multiplying a lambda b lambda minus a lambda b prime lambda. Okay. All right, so the next thing I'm going to do is one of my favorite things to do, which is nothing. Of adding and subtracting the same thing in a clever way. So, CAB minus CAB prime, it's equal to integral over lambda. And now, A lambda B lambda multiplying 1 plus minus A prime lambda B prime lambda. Minus a lambda b prime lambda multiplying 1 plus minus a prime lambda b lambda. See, I didn't mess up anything. A prime, B prime. All right. So this expression and this expression are the same. And you can check by expanding these two products. And the values that are not these ones will cancel. All right. This one is with the one. Okay. This one here with the one. this one here with the one. And the other two that I added are the same when you multiply. So you have a product of this times that. That's going to be equal to this times that. And it will cancel because they're subtractive. Make sense, everybody? All right. So I really did nothing here. Okay. Now, this is nice. It looks like it may be pointless, but it's not, because this, so the reason why I did this nothing is because I'm going to be able to lower bound this. Because if you remember, we know that the variables are binary, so. Okay, that is true. And that means that I can bound this difference. I can bound C AB minus C AB prime. It's going to be less or equal than integral d lambda, lambda 1 plus minus A. A prime lambda d b prime lambda. Okay. That's a typo in the notes there, huh? Missing parentheses. Plus 1 plus minus a prime lambda b. Lambda prime b prime. All right. So what I said is like, well, this thing is going to be less or equal than 1, right? In absolute value, if I take the absolute value of both, then this is going to be the first part in absolute value is not going to give me anything. It's at most 1, the product of these two. So what I'm left is this. And of course, the best case scenario is where the signs of this could be plus or minus 1, this could be plus or minus 1. The best case scenario is when this conspires, right? But still, you know, even with the plus or the minus, this is still true, that is less or equal. Your question, yeah?
Why did you say less than or equal to 1? You start with it's equals plus or minus 1. So why would the absolute...
It's still correct, though, right?
Not just be equal to 1.
No, or minus... This would be equal to 1 minus 1, but it's true. It's still correct, no?
It's correct. Why don't you make the strongest?
Because thing? I don't know if it's minus 1 or 1, so the absolute value of the whole thing, this is at most. So again, it's not true that it's 1 always, right? The outcome of the setting when you do it, maybe I wrote, did I say that it's, yeah. That's why. Sorry about that. What I mean is the outcome of the measurement, right? The outcome of the measurement is what you wait when you integrate over lambda. My bad. Sorry about that. And we have to correct the notes about that. So I was just calling. Make sense? So what I said is plus or minus 1 is not this function. It's the outcome of the measurements. So fix A and B. And you don't know lambda, obviously, so you have to integrate over. Make sense, everybody? All right. Anyway, so this is still true. Keep in mind that our objective is not actually to describe a particular exact result for that. Our objective is to get bounds for it. Okay. All right, so now, this of course, I can decompose as follows. So I have two, let me just write it. This is equal to twice integral d lambda, lambda, plus minus integral d lambda, lambda, a prime lambda, b, b prime lambda, plus minus d lambda, lambda, a prime lambda, b, b lambda. There we go. Agreed? Buddy, just expanding. So we quickly realize this is just one. It's the integral over the whole probability distribution. And these two things are correlation functions. Agreed? So what we have is that the absolute value of a comma b minus the absolute value is a comma b prime. Then what I have here is this is twice 2 plus minus c a prime b prime plus c a prime b. Agreed? All right. Now, of course, that also means putting the correlation functions on one side if you want. This is going to be CAB minus CAB prime minus plus CAB A prime B prime A prime B prime plus C A prime B. Mm-hmm. Less or equal than 2. So let's go to the least optimistic. So this is telling me that this whole combination, let me just a second. The whole combination here would be less than 2, less or equal than 2. But we can go to the best, to the least optimistic scenario. Like, let's try to get the closest to 2. Let's manipulate this to get the closest to 2 possible, right? If we do that, I can take here the signs. So you see these two signs. In the worst case scenario, I missed the absolute value bar right here. Sorry. In the worst case scenario, this would add, this would subtract a 1 from this, or a 2 from this. In the best case scenario, this would have the same sign as the absolute value. So this would be, if this is minus 1 and minus 1, this is positive, and it would take the minus sign. Or if it's positive, it would take the plus sign. So let me just take absolute values of both terms. CAB minus CAB prime plus C A prime B prime plus C A prime B less or equal than 2, all right? Again, this is the most conservative possibility for this. Agreed, everybody? All right, so let me make a box here. The nice thing about this derivation is that this derivation is independent of what experiment you're doing. What this is telling me, well, if your experiment has binary outcomes, and you assume that it's local, so A does not depend on B, on small b, and B does not depend on A, and there's a set of hidden variables that fully determine, let me rephrase the realism as, there's a set of hidden variables that fully determine the outcome of the experiment that you don't have access to necessarily. If that's the case, then the correlators between the outcomes that you get with several experiments that you do combining different settings. So again, you have two sets of settings, right? A and A prime for A, and B prime for B. So if you do the correlator with the first set of settings, the correlator between the two experiments with the first set of settings for A, the second for B, and then the correlator between like the second for A, second for B, and then second for A, first for B, it has to satisfy that this is less or equal than 2, always. Makes sense, everybody? That's pretty cool, huh? This is extremely independent of what you do. Agreed? All right. Now, let's see if that works. They fix that, that's nice. So, this is interesting again because the two assumptions that I made is just locality and realism. And now what we can do is to check, well, can I check if I can violate that So if I have a different theory and I want to test if the theory is local realistic, there's one way. A sufficient condition for not being that is violating this inequality. Because this inequality assumes, to get it, only locality and realism. So the idea that Bell had is, well, how about we check if quantum mechanics can violate this? And that's what we're going to do next. Make sense? All right. So let's pick. Let me define the maximally entangled states for two qubits, for two two-level systems, quantum systems. This is a definition, huh? These four states that you see here are the maximally entangled states for two qubits. Now, again, telling me if a state is entangled could be difficult or whatever, but those are the easy ones, the maximally entangled. Remember the definition of maximally entangled? Maximally entangled states are the pure states that when I trace one of the subsystems, I'm fully ignorant about what's left. Make sense? The case where you have two books, you erase the information of the first one, and the second book becomes gibberish. The books individually have no information, but both together have information. In fact, as much as you can have. Make sense? Everybody? Now, in particular, we're going to select, we're going to make measurements on this state. Let's pick. We could do this with any of the four, by the way, but the I'm going to show you, just picking one of them is going to be enough to violate that, right? So let's pick this one. Let's pick 1 over root 2, 0, A, 1, B, minus 1, A, 0, B, for example. I picked that one because that's the least picked ever. When people pick a Bell state, they don't pick that one. I don't know why, but in the distribution, if you pick one at random, people typically pick this one with the plus, then this one with the plus, then this one with the minus, and this poor thing never gets picked, so we're going to go with that one. That's actually the reason I picked that one. Make sense, everybody? All right. So let's say that Alice can do two kinds of experiments. Two experimental settings. We're going to call A means that Alice measures, there's a typo here, by the way, it says span instead of spin, whatever. Let's say that these are two spins, for example, just to make it easy. Measures spin in the Z axis, or along, rather. Okay, and B, oh sorry, B, A prime, is Alice measures spin along the x-axis. All right? Make sense? Then the same for Bob. Well, not the same, but the same as in Bob can do two kind of experiments. B means Bob measures minus 1 over root 2 sigma ZB plus sigma XB and B prime both measures 1 over root 2 sigma ZB minus sigma XB. So what is this? So if I draw it, Alice can measure spinning the z-axis or spinning the x-axis, and Bob can measure the x minus c axis. So this is, let's say this is z and this is x. So Bob can measure this or that. So this would be a and a prime, and the plus with a minus. So actually it's this, because it's with a minus. This or plus, no, that's not it. That's actually that. So this is minus here is B prime, and this would be B, but with a minus. Makes sense? So 45 degrees, that's the important bit. Makes sense, everybody? Yep.
They're sharing knowledge of the directions.
Yeah, they.
So they have a hidden variable.
No, it's not hidden. They agree.
But they're spatially separated.
No, but they have, everybody's spatially separated has a common past, right?
Right. So it's coming from a common past.
Yeah. So, and they know. They know what it's experimental. In fact, they don't even need to know. Somebody needs to know, because they're going to generate a bunch of data with those settings, and somebody in the future of both will process the data to compute the correlation functions. They can't talk. The correlation functions cannot be computed by them, because they can't talk. Make sense, everybody? All right. Good. Good question. All right, so let's compute. It's satisfying, huh? When it works. All right. All right, perfect. So if we compute, we get, let's compute the observables. So the observables for A, let's just write them, are sigma ZB from B and A prime is going to be sigma X, well, X ZA, of course, sigma XA, I added it on B. And of course, B hat B is minus 1 root 2 A tensor sigma z B plus sigma X B. And B prime, B of B prime, is going to be 1 over root 2 A tensor sigma z B minus sigma X. All right, so it's a matter of now of computing correlation functions, which is the expectation value of the product of both observables. Make sense? So what? Which ones do we need? We need first A and B. Okay. Right, so this is going to be a minus. All right, well, let's compute this. So we get 1 over 2 root 2 from all the factors. And then we get 0a, 1b. I'm going to do maybe two of them, and the other two I leave it for you. Okay? I think then it's going to be in the notes. Sigma set A, tensor sigma set B, plus sigma X B, 0A, 1B,
Yeah,
we can do, because it's not that difficult to do all of them, actually. Minus, in terms of, once I write the first one, it's just a matter of erasing on top and rewriting, so I may do all of them, I don't know. 0A, 1B, sigma set A, tensor, sigma set B, plus sigma XB. I forget how it's everyone. 0B, minus 1A, 0B, sigma set A, tensor, sigma set B, plus sigma XB. Zero A, one B. Finally, 1, 0, sigma set A, tensor, sigma set B, plus sigma XB. 1A, 0. All right. It's very easy, right? Sigma X, sigma Z gives you plus or minus one. So the way I'm gonna do it is just which one you prefer. So let's see. So sigma Z acting on zero. We're gonna call it minus that. And sigma set acting on one, we're gonna call it that. This is a convention, huh? It depends what you want to do with it. You may want one or the other. I'm aware that a very common quantum informational convention here, it's going to be to pick the opposite, right? It doesn't really matter, and then we will say it at the beginning. And it's something to be careful about, because, for example, if you're doing relativistic quantum information, and your qubit, say, is an atom, right? You really want to, it's representing an atom, you really want to call the ground state zero, as you do for a quantum field theory, and the excited state one, so that's why this convention. But it doesn't really matter. In fact, when we see the most common quantum information, at least a convention here, it doesn't matter, right? But if we get, when we do the common quantum informational calculations, we'll pick the right convention, okay, that you'll find in books, so you don't get confused. Make sense? I think it's nice to give it some flexibility. Does that make sense, everybody? Everybody happy with that? All right. Sigma X flips, right? The 0 to the 1. And sigma Z, it gives you a plus 1 or a minus 1 with all the states, because this is expressed already in eigenstates of sigma Z. Make sense? All right, so this one, right, will give me whatever you want. Anyway, doesn't matter. This one will actually not contribute. No, this one does contribute. So for this one, okay, this is perfect. For this one is this one that doesn't contribute, because of course, if I flip one of them, they're gonna be orthogonal. So this one does contribute, and this one does contribute. But in both cases, I get a minus one. So this whole thing is one. Agreed? All right. For this one, you can tell already that this will not give you anything, right? Because these two are orthogonal. So this thing is zero directly. Agreed, everybody? Yep. Are we happy? I don't know. I see like stone-like faces. Tell me nothing. All right. The third one. Third one, same thing. This will give you nothing because the states are orthogonal. So this is zero. Okay. And finally here, this one will give you nothing, but the other one gives you a one. Make sense, everybody? So I get 2. So the result here is 1 over root 2. Agreed. All right. Maybe I can do one more, just one more, right? So if I were to do, so this is the correlator. Let me just write it here, store it here, in the next board here. So I'm going to do it there. Gonna this to the middle. Oh, this is not what it's supposed to be.
Can I ask something?
What's that?
Shouldn't it be minus one?
Why?
The minus of the operator in the second equality. Like A, B. So can you go one equality before that?
Here?
No. Before that equality.
Before the equality?
Yeah.
This one?
You know, before that. In the left side of the board.
Here?
You got the minus in the minus one over the two.
All right. This is my bad. This is minus one indeed, and this is minus one indeed. Sorry about that. That's my arithmetic, right? This thing would give you a minus one with a zero, but a one with a one. So it's minus one. That was just me talking and nobody said anything. That's why the faces, maybe? Do we agree? Asak in arithmetic. This zero, set A zero, give me a minus one. And then one, set B one, gives me a one. So total a minus one. And this is also a minus one, same logic. And because here we have a minus in front of this, so let me just write the minus here, that becomes one root. Make sense, everybody? I'm sorry for that. Again, arithmetics. They're the bane of people like me. Make sense, everybody? Everybody happy with that? I'm sorry about it. It's also very difficult to see it when you're zooming like that. Thanks a lot. All right. So I'm going to store this value here. Above all, when you know the result, right? Because you cannot make it match. So thanks a lot for detecting that. All right, so we had that A, B, oops, one root two. Okay. We can do, for example, A, B prime. All right, so if it's AB prime, this thing is no minus sign and a minus in between. Agreed? Everybody? So this would be a minus. And this would be a minus. This was that, right? So. Ah, oh, no, this is a minus, that's correct. This would be a minus, this would be a minus. This would be a minus. Okay. And I think I transcribed it right. Everybody agrees with that? Anybody detects any issues? On here or here? Okay, so let's compute now.
There's no minus sign.
Sorry, where?
There's no minus sign in front of 1 by 2.
Thank you. Exactly. Because I removed that one, but not that one. Thanks a lot. All right, everybody happy now? All right, let's do that one. So we have the same thing here. This doesn't contribute because it's a flip. We have the same thing here. This doesn't contribute because it's a flip, so this is zero still. Let's say the ones that are zero. The last one here, the second to last is also zero. So this is still the same because we have a sigma set. We haven't changed that. What changes though is what contributes on each. So this one still, yeah, this is still zero, obviously. Algebraically, we haven't really changed anything. The difference, though, so algebraically, is actually the same. But the difference, though, is that here you have minus one. It's actually literally the same thing because the ones that cancel this one, the ones that change sign don't cancel. And here you get a minus one as well. So the difference here is that we don't have the other minus sign that switches everything. So this is minus one root two. Agreed? greet everybody at this case. Okay. So we have A B prime. It's equal to minus 1 root 2. Agreed? All right. We can do directly another one. We can do, let this be A prime B prime, okay? If we do A prime B prime, what changes here is, well, no, that's fine. B prime doesn't change, but now we have an X here. Agreed. So this Z becomes an X. This Z becomes an X. This thing becomes an X. This Z becomes an X. So what is interesting here is now that the ones that contribute are the non-diagonal elements instead of the diagonal ones. So this one is actually 0 in this case, because XA flips the 0 to a 1 and the orthogonal. Here, so this is 0. So this one will not be 0. So this one would make actually 0A, 0A. So this would be a 1. So we need to check what we have in here in this case. So in this case, the because they're orthogonal, the Z doesn't contribute, but the X does contribute because it flips the 0 to a 1. Agreed? But there's a minus and a minus. Well, this is the whole thing here is minus minus 1, so 1. Agreed? Everybody? Right. Again, this one also would not be 0 anymore, because the XA flips the 0 to a 1. And then they're non-diagonal here, so the ZB doesn't contribute, but the XB does contribute, and the XB flips that one and gives you minus minus. So again, this whole thing now is minus minus 1, so 1. And now this thing doesn't contribute, because again, it flips the A, and you have orthogonal one, so 0. So the result here is plus 1 over root 2. Makes sense, everybody? Okay, so let's write it here. A prime B prime equals 1 over root 2. And we're missing just A prime B. So if it's B, now this changes to a minus and a plus. So this is a plus, this is a minus, and this is a plus, and this is a plus, and this is a plus. Okay. But the terms that contribute are the same. So this one is still 0, and this one is still 0, because again, I keep sigma x for A. So it flips. But what I'm left with here is I get this is 0, sorry. I get for XA flips the first one, but XB flips the second one. So this thing is minus 1. Okay. Then it's a plus. It's kind of like before, but you have a plus in here. And this thing is the same, right? So this flips the A, makes it orthogonal. And this flips the B, makes it orthogonal. That's a 1. But because there's a minus sign in front, it's a minus 1. A minus 1 plus minus 1 minus 1 is minus 2. Multiplied by that, and with the sign of the minus 1 there, I get again positive 1 over root 2. Everybody happy? All right, so we did all of them, huh? A prime BB is equal to 1 root 2. Nice. So now that we have that, we can compute that expression. We computed all the correlators, right? So let's compute that expression now. So this is minus a bb prime absolute value plus a prime b prime, all right, plus a prime b b. All right, so this is literally the left hand side of that expression. Agreed, everybody?
Yeah.
So for this particular experiment, thank you. For this particular experiment, let's get the results. So this thing is 1 over root 2. This thing is minus 1 over root 2. This thing is 1 over root 2. This thing is 1 over root 2. So this thing is 2 root 2. This thing is 2 root 2. So the total result is 2 root 2, like that. Agreed, everybody? Well, now that's interesting. Because we have a theoretical prediction of an experiment in quantum mechanics. So if quantum mechanics works the way the postulates have told us to work, if we do such an experiment with the entangled, maximally entangled state psi minus, we obtain that this certainly is violating the inequalities that we obtain for any local realistic experiment done universally with anything. That makes sense, everybody? So clearly, at least the theory of quantum mechanics, is not local realistic. It's violating at least one of the hypotheses that we made at the beginning. And the two hypotheses that I made are locality and realism, and that's it. This is the power of when philosophers of physics do these kinds of theorems, right? Is that they don't care about particulars. They just did a very generic scenario where you can account at the same time for locality and realism. And you know, it took Bell. All the physicists, as intelligent as they were, we're talking Schrödinger, we're talking Bohr, we're talking Einstein, we're talking Podolsky, we're talking Rosen, we're talking everybody in the Solvay conference that actually participated in these discussions. Everybody agreed that there's no way, how am I gonna even set an hypothesis of realism? You know, it's exactly the question that was asked here. How do I even characterize realism mathematically? That's not, this is interpretation, right? And this is also one of the reasons why people call, we will discuss at the end, local realism, locality. That's a thing in quantum information. Eh? You will hear it. The word locality meaning not locality, but actually meaning local realism. We will discuss it at the end. But you see, they didn't have a way. They couldn't come up with a way. But it was a Bell arrives, right, and says, well, actually, there's a way. Here. Any local realistic theory has to satisfy this between the correlations of experiments with two sets of settings, right? Regardless of what the hidden variables are, just that they exist. Quantum mechanics, the theory, predicts a violation of that. So quantum mechanics, as a theory, is not local realistic. Now, Bell says, well, now go to our lab and check if you can do that in reality, because there are two options, right? Either reality is local realistic and quantum mechanics is wrong, or at least cannot cover everything, right? Or the experiment confirms this result, and then quantum mechanics is maybe a good experiment, a good description of the world. Right? But in any case, you violate local realism. Whatever it is, even if it's not quantum mechanics, it would not be local realism. Makes sense, everybody? So people went to the lab. And the first time that this was done in the lab to a level that is kind of acceptable for physicists was in 1984. Nobel Prize in Physics for doing it.
That's among other things.
Quantum optics, the Nobel Prize in Physics. So that experiment was done in 1984. Of course, there were many loopholes in that experiment that philosophers said, no, but hold on, you have not, you're doing it with light. They were doing it with light. They generate entangled states using nonlinear media, okay? And this nonlinear media creates, if you want, entangled states that are similar, or at least in spirit similar to that. Not quite, because what they have is, well, sometimes I can measure two correlated, as they call it, photons or wave packets coming out of the nonlinear crystal with polarizations that are in that entangled state. But I miss some of them. So the total state is actually mixed in a way because I have noise. But I can just select on the cases where the measurements were actually acceptable. And then the philosopher said, no, no, but to compute the correlations, you need to compute to count all the statistics. You need to repeat the experiment many times. You know, these are expectation values after all. And how do you know that the ones that you can detect are actually conspiring, right? So that the ones that you don't detect, which are the majority, when you work with light, the ones that you don't detect maybe ruin this. You see what I mean? That's a very clear loophole. I'm doing a very selective statistics. I'm assuming that I have a principle of repeatability of identical experiments, all of them. They are, you know, the ones that I miss are exactly the same distribution of the ones I miss. But maybe not. You see, it's a loophole in a way. Maybe nature conspires like that. The ones that you can detect are exactly the ones that give you that, and then you ruin the experiment. Also, the first time it wasn't as much as 2 root 2, it was above 2, but not yet, and so on. It is considered that all those, there's also the loophole that the two labs were not really spaced like separated. Oh, how do you guarantee locality? You see what I mean? Like, how do you guarantee that there's no talking between the two, right? Things like that. Anyway, all these loopholes have been now considered closed. Again, there's still some because experiments are not perfect. But in 2015, I think it was 2015, around 2015 plus minus one, it was proven, doing it with electrons, not with light. And with electrons is nice because you can control the events and not miss and know exactly what you miss. And you do it with electrons, then you have full control on that. You not have phantom statistics. You just need enough statistics so that the rest, no matter how crazy it is, won't ruin the whole average. Those loops are closed, and it's considered nowadays that indeed the experiments agree with this theoretical prediction of quantum mechanics. Yeah?
So I have two questions. One of them is, you know, it's very common to hear that the experimental verification of Bell's inequalities disproves, quote, theories of local hidden variables. Is the correct way to say it, local theories of hidden variables?
Yeah.
Okay, that's one.
So there's another thing that, there's another way of building this, which is if you want non-local hidden variables, it's very similar to the pilot wave formulation of quantum mechanics. So instead of, you have some variables that are not controllable by experiment, if you want, there are certain phases, and those phases that are not measurable are certainly not local, and you can reproduce the experiment. In fact, pilot wave theory is one-to-one with quantum mechanics, meaning that it's another formulation of quantum mechanics. It's not different. So philosophers may disagree on what it is, but pilot wave theory is certainly not local realistic either. Pilot wave theory does violate locality. Now, the issue, people have opinions about this. The issue with pilot wave theory is that they have no way to reproduce relativistic results because obviously relativity comes with locality, comes equipped with locality. So there are attempts that people try to do relativistic pilot wave theory in which they impose extra restrictions so that there's no signaling, even though you have non-locality intrinsically. So far, there's no such thing as a QFT formulation based on pilot wave theory. And in any case, in the cases of relativistic quantum mechanics, they're equivalent. So it's another formulation of quantum mechanics. That's it. Just another mathematically more complex formulation of quantum mechanics. But yeah, certainly, indeed. This is local hidden variables. Called local hidden variables.
And yeah. you made a nice segue to the second question I had in mind. So I've been trying to think throughout like the formulation of quantum mechanics itself. And I don't think that at any point we have imposed the the locality as we understand it from relativity is important.
Oh, no, that's QFT, yeah?
That's QFT.
Yes.
So
in quantum mechanics only, no. Yeah.
So why would we expect quantum mechanics to be local then?
No, I'm imposing locality here, you see? So I'm saying when I choose the operators here, there's a set of local operators. I'm imposing it. So it's not because of a foundational notion of quantum mechanics. It's because I'm saying there exist measurements like this and like that, which is I do nothing on my lab on B, but I'm measuring on A, and this only touches A, this measurement. So this is an extra assumption here imposed. If we were working with a description of the Bell experiment in QFT, then that's automatic. I don't need to do it. I just say, my operation is localized in this region of space-time. I have some region of space-time, right? Some region of space-time here. It's already local. It's imposed by the fact that there are if you have them spaced like separated. And microcausality, which is one of the actions of QFT, the fact that local operators in space-time regions that are spaced like separated would commute, so you're fine. But then again, no, in quantum mechanics, just I have to impose it. I have somebody telling me, no, I'm doing local measurements here. It's certainly one of the loopholes in terms of that you have to close. Like, how do you make sure that your measures are local like that? You see? because of course to prove that the immersors are local, and you require something like that. But keep in mind that, as you said, this is a notion of locality that you cannot impose it, but it's true that nobody's saying that the theory is local. So the fact that you're choosing that is not telling you that the theory is local. Theory may not be local. In fact, this theorem doesn't tell you if the theory is local. This theorem tells you that it's not local realistic, period. Maybe locality fails. This theorem would not be able to tell. Maybe what's failing is the assumption of locality. Make sense? So yeah, no, I agree with you. I'm imposing some notion of local measurements, but I'm not saying anything about quantum mechanics being local here or not. I'm saying that quantum mechanics is not local realistic.
So would QFT verify the version quality then?
Sure. Yeah, but I mean, you can do a QFT version of that. So this is my reason to say that what I expect to fail is not locality, it's realism. What everybody would expect to fail is realism, not locality. Because if you do the same thing with QFT, that has a, or you don't even need to go as far as QFT. I can impose a notion of locality from relativity in an experiment doing that. You see, I forget the theory. Imagine I do the experiment, and I make sure that my labs, when they measure, were space-like separated. That is imposing the relativistic notion of locality. With that relativistic notion of locality, then you're violating this, so all that is left is realism. Important note, often in quantum mechanics and often in quantum foundations, in quantum information, in quantum foundations, you would say that you would hear that quantum mechanics is not local. Not local because of entanglement, and everybody's happy because they have this intuition, oh, measure here, magic, to the other side. That's very bad. What should be said is that it's not local realistic. And in fact, if you ask me, I would say it's not realistic. Make sense? Even though people decided to short it as local. And that is because the old discussions. In the old discussions, they did not distinguish. The one that they can talk about is locality and not realism. They didn't know how. But yeah, quantum mechanics is not local realistic. And if you ask me on top of that, because of the plethora of experiments proving that at least in the levels of energy that we work on, locality is, there's a notion of locality in the universe imposed by relativity, at least at low energies, right? Then I would say that locality is more sacred than realism. And if you ask me, I would say, no, just quantum mechanics is not realistic in the sense that there's no local hidden variables. You had a question? No. Okay. Sometimes I confuse the, sorry about that. That makes sense? So that's actually kind of a segue to what I wanted to say. Quantum mechanics is not local realistic. It's up to you to decide which one you like least, the least. Realism or locality? If you ask me, I don't like realism. If I have to choose, I mean, ideally, both are nice, no? In a way, they're like kind of cool assumptions to make, reasonable assumptions to make, right? But if you have to violate one, as you have to, then I think there better be realism than locality. Why? Because we have relativity. Oh, but maybe relativity fails at high energies, 100%. Maybe whatever the real structure of the causal structure of the universe, maybe what we see as relativity is emerging from something else. Maybe that something else is not local. Maybe locality is violated at the fundamental level. I cannot tell, right? Because we don't have a good theory of microstructure of space-time yet. But at least at the level of energies that we're doing these scenarios, we have cosmology tells us that Lorentz invariance is not violated to the 10 to the minus 40 something, I forget. So at the levels of energy that we have, any levels of energy that we can observe, we have not violated Lorentz invariance. It seems that relativity and the locality notion of relativity at the energies that we can do these experiments works to the nausea. So realism is, for me, the way to go. Some people do not like that. Like, for example, if you go to pilot wave, it's true that it's a smaller community, but if you go to the pilot wave people, they say, well, it's locality maybe what fails. And realism is there. And they can build. So you can build a theory that has some notion of realism. It's not local realism, right? But you have a notion of realism, but then you give up locality. You can build that.
Realism and locality, things like they're two separate things.
They are.
Aren't they interrelated? Because you're assuming you've got identity in these equations, but if you've got hidden variables, you may not be able to get the identity on.
I agree. I pick my experiments. All that I need is pick one experiment, one that violates those inequalities. So I pick this one. I could have an observable that is non-local. I could have an observable that is correlated. I could have the sum of sigma z sigma x plus sigma x sigma z. And that is a correlated observable. Okay, that's a different story. But I pick this one because I just need one scenario where that is violated. That's all.
Right, but how do you know that you've got identity on one side?
Well, this is how you would model this experiment in quantum mechanics. Maybe it's not the right way to model it. Okay. The same question could be asked, how do you know you have sigma z? You see what I mean? What we have, when we have a Stern-Gerlach experiment in one lab, we are assuming that we have, measuring this operator, we're doing a measurement on the spin of this particle, but we're doing nothing on the second. That's the identity. The experiment only touches one particle. So yeah, I'm picking my observables to be local, to violate that. But that doesn't mean maybe the theory in its guts has some non-locality on top of that. See, the locality imposed here is only in the choice of observables. Maybe the theory in its guts has some non-locality. I don't know, you see? The choice of observables to measure does not tell you, even if they're local, when you choose, you're not imposing locality in the theory. You're picking one particular choice in the theory. Now, of course, someone can say, but how do you know that's a good description for the experiment? Agreed, let's do the experiment. That's what we did. And this description seems to work. Make sense? So, slightly conceptual in both framework, let's say. This is certainly a choice of local observables, okay? But that doesn't mean the theory is local, or I'm imposing locality in the theory. Maybe in its guts it's not local, I don't know, okay? Second, I pick those because it's enough to pick one setting that violates that. Third, but what if this setting is really not realistic? How do you know you have the identity, as you said there? Well, sure, let's go to the experiment and see if this is a setting that works. And then in that experiment, of course, nobody. It's not that when this was found, people said automatically, oh, hold on, so the world is non-local realistic, right? No, no, people said, ah, quantum mechanics is non-local realistic. Let's go to an experiment and see if that experiment confirms that nature is non-local realistic. Make sense, everybody? Okay, so just to tell you, this is, as you can tell, the resource that we use it here in this experiment to violate local realism explicitly is a maximally entangled state. So as you may be suspecting, there's something special about entanglement that manifests itself in violations of local realism. If I didn't pick an entangled state, I'm not able to violate local realism, okay? So another way of thinking of entanglement as a resource is, as a resource. A resource that allows you to violate local realism. In your theory, that you consume entanglement to violate local realism. So that's very related with operations that you can do, as we will see, and protocols that we can do in quantum information, like quantum teleportation, for example. Or if you go to a QFT, a relativistic quantum information protocol, what is called quantum energy teleportation. I will end up the course. Makes sense? So the next step that we're going to do is study entanglement, as in like, okay, how do that? You convince me, I hope. I convince you that entanglement is an interesting resource, no? It may be from the fundamental point of view, saying, well, it's actually a cool feature of the theory, but it's even better. It allows you to do things that you cannot really do with classical theories, no? Yeah.
Can you have entanglement but not violate Bell's inequality?
Completely, yes. You can have entanglement and not enough to violate Bell's inequality. You need to have enough entanglement to violate Bell's inequalities. And what does enough mean? Well, I don't know because I haven't told you how to measure entanglement, right? Why haven't I told you? I should have told you maybe. Well, because it's freaking difficult to measure entanglement. So the next block of the course is going to be about quantifying entanglement, or at least doing our best to quantify entanglement, because they're going to be compromises we have to take. Make sense? All right, so that would be next day.